The subcommittee, salary subcommittee, will please come to order. I thought that, who is the actuary?
He's right here, Mark.
Right. I wonder if you'd come forward, and we'd like to take your testimony on whatever bills that your testimony is particularly relevant for.
Pick anyone.
This one.
Might start with the ones that have been referred to.
Yeah, right. Ones that have at least got a marginal likelihood of getting in.
Yeah, we're not having any hearings on bills that are not referred to the committee.
That's a good way to start, Frank.
Let's start with House Bill 2851. Are you familiar with this one?
Just the retiree health insurance?
Yes.
For the record, my name is Mark Johnson. I'm a consulting actuary with the firm of Milliman and Robertson, hired by the PERS board. You should have in front of you a letter dated June 20th.
Right.
In which I responded to the question about raising the monthly subsidy from $50 to $60 per month. And the question was, would the contributions that are already earmarked for that trust be adequate to provide the $60 subsidy rather than the $50 subsidy that's currently in the statute? I just recap briefly in that letter some of the basics of the starting point. As you recall, this was a $350 million endowment 2 years ago. The Attorney General says that cannot be continued. When the $350 million was withdrawn from PERS, we did a subsequent actuarial evaluation. We essentially raised employer rates by 0.6% of payroll to cover the loss of the $350 million. And when we did the valuation, there were all sorts of other gains and losses that most employers either had a flat rate or reduction, but one of the components was that increase of 0.6% of payroll. We were asked in February to look at how high the subsidy could go. At that point in time, we did not know about the Attorney General's questions. The trust fund had grown to $400 million due to two reasons. Number one, good investment results. Number two, the number of people who enrolled in the program was significantly less than the maximum that could. We said that a 15% increase in 1990 and again in 1991 could be supported by an interest rate of 7.6%, which is very close to what we assume in PERS for long-term funding of the system of 7.5%. The June 9th letter answering the question about can we go to $72, in our opinion, that would have been stretching it, and even an increase in the contribution of 0.5% from 0.6 to 0.6500 would have caused the account to be in a deficit position for almost 40 years. Now the question about going to $60, I point to the graph, which is, this should be the last page of the letter. The top graph indicates what would have happened had we still had the endowment. And I've run this at three different interest rates. The 7%, 7.5%, which is our current long-term assumption under PERS, and 8%. And you can see that even under the 7% assumption, the $60 subsidy would be very doable. However, we're not in that situation. We do not have the $400 million endowment. We have to start over with zero. Every asset that had been in the retiree health trust is coming back to PERS. It's being rewound back to where it was. And the way the Attorney General has drafted the legislation to comply with Internal Revenue Service regulations on funding health insurance inside a qualified pension plan as opposed to outside, we can only use new money to fund the subsidy. Now, therefore, we're starting out with assets of zero. And if everyone signs up for the program, you can see that we are in a deficit position, although a relatively modest one compared to some of our other projections. And we will work out of this sometime after the turn of the century. The figures on the deficit are on the previous page at the bottom. Under the 7.5% scenario, where we're starting out with zero in 1989, you can see that 5 years from now, we're looking at a deficit of about $27 million, $63 million. It finally turns around sometime around 2015 and comes back into the black. The mechanism now that's being dealt with of the retiree health account inside of PERS must be funded by new contributions. A higher, and what we're dealing with is something different than PERS. PERS is a system where the benefit is based upon final average salary, something that's always increasing. And we're making projections for that, and we come up with a level contribution as a percentage of payroll that funds that. What we're talking about here is a flat dollar amount. In absent future legislation, we're dealing with something that's always going to be $60, no matter what salary does. So when we have a level contribution as a percentage of salary, and if salaries increase, the funds coming in to pay for this are going to increase. That's why this is going to come back in the future, even with more and more retirees, and we're running a deficit now. It's going to go in the hole for a short period, for a significant period of time, and then we'll come back. Our feeling is that when we do the next valuation, and this is a part of the PERS account, we will look at it. I don't have any reason to believe that the long-term contribution rate to support the $60 benefit will be anything different than 6/10 of a percent of payroll. If it was just a several hundredths higher, this graph would be above the break-even point. So it's very sensitive to very small change in future contributions, because future contributions, again, are as a percentage of pay. As pay increases, you're going to get more and more dollars coming in to fund something that's essentially a flat $60 benefit. So in our opinion, the way we're set up now with the 6/10 of a percent of payroll already plugged into employer contribution rates, we feel that the $60 subsidy is as far as you'd want to go at this point in time.
But it is doable with 0.6. You could go 60 without any adverse effect over time.
That's correct.
But not any more than that.
Right. We showed, I think, in a previous letter what happens if you were up to $72 and the thing just just falls off the bottom.
Sure. If you went to 65, what?
I believe I did 65 back in February. We were looking at the endowment at that point in time. It was doable under the endowment, as I recall.
Right. Probably wouldn't be here unless you raised the.
No, I think what you're looking at, what you'd be looking at, is significantly higher deficits, particularly around the turn of the century and so forth. A much longer period of time to come back.
Would you describe a little for me, a little bit more, what this deficit is and who pays it?
Okay, the legislation that's drafted. We insisted they put in a provision for borrowing from PERS because we knew that that.
So these deficits would be covered by borrowing from PERS.
Borrowing from PERS. So the trust as a whole is not borrowing from anybody else. It's taking it from one pocket and putting it in another. And when we do the actuarial valuation, you'll never see. I mean, it's invisible outside of PERS. So it's a bookkeeping mechanism to keep straight what dollars are being paid for the retiree health account and what are not.
This borrowing represents what proportion of the total trust?
Right now the total trust is I presume somewhere around $9 billion. We're talking in 5 years from now borrowing $27 million. 5 years from now the trust might be $11 or $12 billion, and talk about borrowing being a deficit in this one aspect of the PERS program of $27 million, in our opinion, that's
so based
very minor.
On this kind of estimate, the impact upon the trust is infinitesimal. The borrowing.
the borrowing, I don't think should be an issue. I think the issue should be, does this graph eventually come up to the break-even point, or are you legislating something that has no hope of making it with 0.6% of payroll? I mean, I figure that my role here is to tell you what this is going to cost. And in my opinion, the 0.6% of payroll, as we're funding other PERS benefits, will be adequate to fund this over a long period of time, notwithstanding that in the next 20 or 25 years, there'll be a modest deficit. Now, I should also comment that this is premised on every retiree who's eligible for the subsidy signing up. As you know, 2 years ago, that also was our presumption, that everybody would sign up. Everybody did not, because of what I consider to be some plan design problems with the trust. Those problems are being addressed by a task force, by the health consultants to PERS, and our assumption here is that everybody will sign up. If everybody does not sign up for one reason or another, the picture will be brighter than what we're showing on this graph.
I assume that these loans that are shown here as deficits for each, roughly each 5 years, these are cumulative?
Yes. So what we're doing is you're working yourself, as you can see, you're working yourself out of it by the year 2020, roughly.
Well, do you add 27 additional deficit each year, or is that
this is where you are. This is where you are in that particular year.
Okay.
You're at 27. You're in the hole 27 million 5 years from now. Mm-hmm. 10 years from now, you're in the hole 63 million. It's not.
Okay.
You know, you're not adding each one. This is where you are at that point.
What's the depth and what is the deepest the hole will get in terms of what we have to borrow a year?
At 7.5% interest, somewhere around $135 million.
So it would go 135 finally before it began to turn around.
Right.
Okay. At what year would it be?
I think we said that was 2014.
Right. The percent of the total trust fund, since the trust fund is growing, or we hope it's growing every year.
It grows lower and lower.
Yeah. A drop in the bucket, frankly.
Yeah. Yeah.
And even if the assumption rate is increased to 8, it still is not a significant difference.
Right. Well, the interesting thing is, if the assumption rate has changed, this will look worse because they're in deficit.
That's
to owe more.
Figures show here, yeah.
Right. But so it's really not sensitive to the interest rate at all because it's not generating a huge fund.
When does the drop in the bucket become more than a drop and would necessitate an increase in the percentage rate?
Well, in costing out this benefit by itself, I think the criteria that I used was I wanted to make sure that it was going to be self-supporting over a reasonable point in time.
Okay, and 0.6, and if it went up to 65, you don't think you could find out there at some point of time when it would be self-supporting?
That's right. It would be longer than any time period with which the PERS board has had to deal with funding.
In 2 years, we've got to go up to $75 because 60 is not adequate. We'll probably have to increase that percentage some.
That's correct.
And this, of course, is going to be the problem that's going to be faced in the legislature if we have continuous increases in the cost of insurance. Then there's going to be pressure to increase to 60 to 65 or 70 and so forth. And I guess that's if we were to approve this one, that's a pressure that some future legislature is going to have to face.
Well, I don't think it's an unreasonable pressure, and if you really have a program that you want to provide adequate insurance, the cost of insurance keeps going up, and clearly the fund can afford this, and it probably can afford some moderate increases into the future.
Well,
Chairman, Mark, did anybody try to figure out what would happen rather than change this drastically over a period of time to change the formula as to the effect upon the fund? If you went to 2.0 and then we'd have to go back on ad hocs, but basically try to give people some more cash on their basic monthly retirement to take care of increased medical cost rather than affect this fund. Would it be really about the same, wouldn't it, or would it?
Well, I'm not a health actuary. I'm not the expert. I believe there's a tax advantage to this.
To this?
Yes. It's essentially, if if the premium is $60, and we know that it might be more than $60 coming up, but if the premium is $60, this subsidizes that premium. And my understanding is the retirees are receiving that coverage without any out-of-pocket cost and without any income tax liability for that cost.
That's if they take standard deduction. If they are deductors, then the fact that you pick up the medical cost is a disadvantage.
I see.
Because what has happened, I think, in the case of people that are having to getting their medical paid for, they may have wished that would have actually been, they'd been paying for it in some way because it would have become a tax deductible item. So standard deduction, folks, basically gain the advantage if this stays this way.
I would suggest that you talk to the health consultant for PERS if you have further questions on that. I'm just not qualified to give more answers on the advantages and disadvantages of doing this versus the other. I know that a lot of time was spent 2 years ago designing this for that specific reason, right, that there was an advantage to doing this rather than the alternative at the time that was being discussed was just a flat ad hoc increase to retirees, and this was the desired approach.
Well, the real desired approach was the endowment of
well, exactly. I mean,
because what happens then is that fund grew, you could then start paying more. Now that we're basically back inside the fund and we can't treat it as an individual account, is that correct?
No, you can as long as it's funded through new money. And there are restrictions
on
how much money.
Yeah,
I mean,
so
you can't contribute $350 million in 1 year. It has to be there's a maximum as a percentage of the total contribution that you can put into it.
Do you know what it is? Where is it? A constitutional thing that says it has to be funded by new money, or is it just a statutory?
It's Internal Revenue Service.
Federal
Internal Revenue Code. Because what we want to do, Senator, is to maintain the tax qualified status of the trust to protect the tax implications of the pickup. In order to do that, we can't do anything inside the trust that violates certain provisions of the Internal Revenue Code. That's one of them.
We didn't know that last time we created this.
Well, we were outside the trust last time.
Oh.
We were in an endowment, which was, therefore, it did well, anything you did in the endowment didn't hurt.
Why can't we stay outside the trust then?
The Attorney General said we can't do that.
And why? And what's the reason there?
Because we violated contractual rights on taking money out of the fund that essentially was earmarked for other purposes.
We took money out of a trust fund. That's naughty.
Okay.
We've done it before, but this time
Okay. Based on apparently a group of decisions he's making, and it's based on the Constitution. Is that it?
That's correct.
Okay.
I should make one more final point that even in the endowment scenario, that was designed for a level $50. That was not designed to be incrementing up every year. The interest only on that was designed to pay the $50 subsidy. So as health costs go up, that endowment would have to be supplemented with another layer every time you wanted to raise the $50. Now, it just so happened that the maximum number of people didn't sign up. You had great investment return. You could have done more. But there's no guarantee that it would have been that way. It could have gone the other way in certain years. So. I think that the scenario that was established was still for a level $50, and you're absolutely correct that you're going to have to face this problem every time to look at that subsidy and to see what it costs. Now the way it's developed, being inside a PERS, we'll be able to get a real good handle on what the cost is.
How is the $350 million to be paid back?
Goes right back where it came from. It came out of several different reserve accounts.
Are there costs involved to the employers? Does it affect the rate at all?
No.
It's just putting it back.
Right.
With some interest.
Yes. Whatever interest it earned.
With the interest that it earned.
Right.
So there's no fiscal really implication
no,
for that.
No. That's
all.
Correct.
Mr. Chair.
Yes.
How is it possible to have a trust fund that's growing like this, the overall big trust fund, and it's growing substantially because of its investment earnings, and to get some of the result of that back to those who are the beneficiaries of the trust, people basically who are either paying into it or have retired and want to benefit from it, without having to increase the price to the employer every time you do something? How can they benefit from the earnings without us always having to do the battle of, you've got every additional thing you do for the beneficiaries, you've got to charge upfront monies?
It's a very good question. Let me answer it this way. There's really more than one step involved. What we're doing in front of you when you're meeting and looking at this is pricing out benefit and changes, and what it would cost, what the employer would have to put in additional monies if everything else was stayed the same, if this was the only thing that was happening. When the fund earns more than we assume, or there are other gains, people don't live as long as we thought, people retire later than we thought, salaries don't go up, whatever the gains might be, those are plugged in when we do the actuarial valuation. So for example, 2 years ago, when we were talking about this health trust, I told you that, in my opinion, the rate should be increased by 0.6% of payroll. At the time, we were sitting 18 months after valuation in a tremendous investment market, and I knew, and I sat here and I said that the rate will go down more than 0.6%. And that's, I think, how you have to deal with it. That you're looking at the cost of this as one element. The other elements are actuarial gains and losses. Now, fortunately, the crash of October 87 didn't deplete all of those earnings, so there was still enough, for example, for the state that their rate did not go up by 0.6%. Two-thirds of the local employers either had their rates stay the same or go down.
Now, what can you tell us about this time, as you think in terms of what the market's doing? Even though we say these rates are going up, they may not actually go up because of what the market's doing, right?
That's correct.
And what's going to happen? Can you give us some idea?
The market now is ahead of our actual assumption. Mm-hmm. To the extent it is, and what impact, it's not as clear as it was 2 years ago. I mean, 2 years ago, there were phenomenal rates of return, mm-hmm. and there was just no question. We actually, they were so phenomenal that we were asked to look at it and see what the impact. Nobody's asked us to look at it, so it's kind of hard off the cuff.
We had that chart, you know, here.
Yeah, right.
But the problem with doing that is that that's only looking at one element of potential gains and losses. Yeah. The problem I ran into, I guess it was 4 years ago, was there were investment gains, but other actuarial losses had a greater impact than those gains, and those losses were due to, frankly, the Oregon economy, that there were no other jobs to go to, and employee turnover was so much lower than we assumed. More people were staying in the plan. People weren't leaving and forfeiting benefits. Therefore, since there are more people there, the cost of retirement is going to go up. So, I mean, more people with longer service. So you can get blindsided by only looking at one element of the actuarial gain and loss. Now, the investment return is by far and away the most publicized, the most easily isolated. Therefore, it's very popular to look at that one only.
When we look at a bill like Senate Bill 573, and I know we're going to get there, but that's the one that provides for an ad hoc increase to the beneficiaries. And we are told the cost to the employer is such and such to do this. But I guess what I've
we're
always
have to interrupt. Call the Senate.
Well, let me finish my question.
Well, let's not hold up the Senate, Cliff. We can come back to this. I'm sorry, but we're holding up all the other members. Just if we stay a couple minutes here, so we're in recess.
We'll hold. Mark.